Apart. From Aristotle to Hegel to Fukuyama, the idea of history gravitating to some moral end has been one of the most generative and most destructive Western concepts, giving rise to both Christianity and fascism, both Marxism and liberalism. With the conflict in Ukraine rekindling the old disputes about the right and the wrong sides of history, is there still a chance for Russia and the West meeting somewhere in the middle? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Ephraim Inbar, president of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategic Studies. Professor Inbar, it's great to see you. Great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
You wrote recently about this seemingly existential political need to be perceived as being on the right side of history. And if we try to put politics and propaganda out of it and look at it from a historical and perhaps psychological perspective, what's underneath this righteousness?
I don't believe there is a right side of history. Basically, the history is written by the victors of the wars, and the narratives that remains in the future is the one that is defined by the victors. By the way, Hitler was not far from victory. If you would have put more attention to the nuclear issue rather than long-range missiles, he might have been the victor. Would it be the right side of history? I doubt it.
Now, the tensions between Russia and the West, especially over Ukraine, have been building for quite some time, a couple of years, if not decades. Yet when I interview Western experts, they always point out that the Russian actions in Ukraine, however disagreeable they may be, are totally unprovoked. They see it as totally unprovoked, totally coming out of the blue. Do you think that's a deliberate obfuscation, or is it a genuine blindness on their part that they somehow missed the last couple of years of the very tenuous relationship between our sides?
I can understand there is a security dilemma. Somebody that tries to defend himself and accumulates power, military power, to defend itself. At the same time, it projects a threat to its neighbor. So this type of situations are inevitable. I definitely understand the Russian desire for larger margins of security. We have to remember that NATO expanded eastward, closer to Russian borders, when it was promised to the Kremlin rulers at that time that this will not happen. I'm pretty sure that NATO doesn't harbor any offensive intentions, but at the same time, it's very difficult to dismiss the fears of Russia, and they have historic fears of invasion from the West. So this is precisely the problem of a security dilemma.
And Inbar, we often hear from Western experts that NATO doesn't harbor any explicit offensive intentions vis-a-vis Russia. But, you know, looking at some of the recent actions by NATO members, be it in Libya or in Syria, you know, maybe they were not intentional, but they happened nonetheless. I mean, is it really so crucial to, you know, have this written as a statement of purpose that NATO does not want to attack Russia, rather than, you know, pursuing from the realpolitik perspective and seeing what NATO members have done militarily in recent history?
I think the Russians had an understanding with Obama, and Obama misled the Russians in Libya. Syria is seen by the Russians, justly or not, as their backyard in the Middle East. So they think that they have a right to intervene. The Americans disagree. And instead of sitting down and trying to divide the world. This is your part, this is my part. And try to coexist as it was during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a great misunderstanding in the West on how to run foreign policy. They become too liberal, too have illusions about what international relations really is. And as a result of that, there are misperceptions on both sides.
Now, I take it from your writing that you take the fulfillment of national interests rather than morality as the ultimate measure of any policy. You wrote that, and I'm quoting you here, that no country is allowed to gamble on its very existence. And I think that's pretty clear in how Israel conducts itself on the international stage. But if we look at Russia from that perspective, do you think Russia had a choice other than to act militarily with Ukraine becoming increasingly militarized and increasingly hostile to Russia?
First of all, I want to clarify, a country has no right, no moral right to commit suicide. And therefore, it has to act upon its national interests. There are always choices. There is a choice to surrender also. So Russia obviously has many choices. And it chose to act militarily in order to defend its national interests in Ukraine. And this was following a series of warnings to the West, but the West didn't take it seriously. And I'm not making any judgment, any moral judgment. I can understand the behavior of a state that wants to have larger margins of security. Israel wants larger margins of security. And I would like to point out that Ukraine was to some extent without caution. When you live next to a big bear like Russia, you have to be careful. That's all.
I have a chuckle about Russia being a big bear. I think we are a little bit more civilized than that. We no longer live in the woods. But if that's the perception, so be it. I want to ask you about...
I didn't mean to offend you or the Russians.
Absolutely.
But Russia is a large country, a big country, with a tradition of using force.
Now, Israel
is... You cannot disregard it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Israel is also, despite being much smaller, it's also a country that takes its survival very seriously. And you are definitely not shy about striking targets on other countries' territory. And I think to some extent, Israel's force projection relies on its adversaries knowing that some sort of retribution is inevitable. So I want to ask you whether you think that the drastic actions that Russia is now taking in Ukraine is... that they are at least partially conditioned on Russia being hesitant and toothless or clawless, to use your bear metaphor, for way too long. Had Russia reacted earlier and more forcefully, could the current crisis have been avoided?
Frankly, I think that this war could have been averted primarily by the United States paying attention to Russian security concerns. Also by the hubris of the Ukrainian leadership, not understanding that certain actions may provoke Russian sensitivities. And as a result, we have a war, which is not a very nice thing. People lose their lives. Cities are destroyed. But this is part of war.
Now, within the Western camp, Israel has a very interesting position because it tends to vote alongside many Western resolutions condemning Russia's behavior, but it is also not dismissive of Russia's security concerns. What's the Israel's game or the Israel's rationale in this conflict?
The Israeli rationale is very clear. On one hand, we are... dependent upon the United States, part of what they call the free world. and we are want to be in the American camp. On the other hand, not far from where I live, the Russian army is in Syria, and we reached an agreement to coordinate our military actions, so the Israeli military actions in Syria against Iranian targets, which is something which is extremely important to Israel's national security. And we want to make sure that this coordination continues, which is dependent upon Russian goodwill and national interests. So we try to balance our participation in what's called the Western camp with a realistic position vis-a-vis our neighbor, which is Russia. Russia is our neighbor, and we have to take it into consideration. We are not acting idealistically. I think the general outlook of Israeli foreign policy is realpolitik. And as a result of that, we are trying to balance those two interests, which is not only us. India is doing the same. Some Arab countries are doing the same. We're not alone in what you call this game. Russia is an important actor, and we have to take into consideration its national interests when we act in its vicinity.
Now, you mentioned Russia's presence in Syria, and I think one other country to mention here is Turkey. And I think you would probably agree that in Syria, Russia was both firm and accommodating. It was respectful of both Turkey's and Israel's existential security considerations, but it also could repel some of the actions when it deemed them excessive. So that allows me to conclude that at least with Israel and Turkey and Syria, Russia has learned how to differentiate between the various uses of power and force. Why didn't work the same way with Ukraine?
First of all, I agree with you that Russia was very pragmatic when it decided to intervene on part of the Assad regime. Taking into consideration the Israeli interests, the Turkish interests, and also the Iranian interests. In Ukraine, basically there was no part. The current leadership, which is, I would say, it, you know, anti-Russian and enamored with the idea of being part of Europe, didn't play a pragmatic game. And as a result of that, as I mentioned, this is part one reason for the war we are witnessing.
Now, since I mentioned Turkey, you know that it's a very challenging partner for both Russia and Israel, especially under Prime Minister Erdogan. And
President.
To Moscow.
He's the president. Don't tell him that he's prime minister.
Absolutely. That's my mistake. President. How could I forget that? But anyway, he's been in power for way too long, for quite some time, I should say. I should really watch my tongue here. He's been in power for way for quite some time. And
it's 2001.
Yes, and our countries have gone through the periods of acute crisis and very pragmatic relationship. And we managed to restore some sort of partnership after the very precarious incident back in 2015 when the Turks shot down a Russian military jet in Syria, which was taken in Moscow as a step in the back. And yet it worked towards restoring some sort of a pragmatic relationship. Could that serve as a model for future adversaries? Could that serve as a model for either Russia and Ukraine going forward, or perhaps Russia and the West going forward?
I think Ukraine is basically a minor actor. And the what we see developing is a power game between the United States and its allies and Russia. And there were times when America had a different leadership, and the two countries reached a détente, during the Kissinger times. I definitely deplore the fact that the United States doesn't have a Kissinger at this time that understands international politics, understands power politics, and understands that sometimes you have to accommodate your adversaries because they have national interests And in international relations, unless you are extremely strong, you can't get everything.
Professor Inbar, we have to take a very short break right now. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
To Worlds Apart with Efraim Inbar, president of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategic Studies. Professor Inbar, one of the proposed goals of the Russian military operation in Ukraine is the so-called denazification. And I have to say that when I first heard this term, it sounded very odd and artificial. I think it took the Russian speakers a couple of weeks to even learn how to pronounce it without stumbling. Having said that, do you think Nazism or fascism has ever been a problem in modern day Ukraine?
It depends what modern day. We remember Petlura, who sided with the Nazis. But I'm sorry, I do not know enough about the politics of Ukraine today to be able to respond to that. I must say that this sentence sounds very strange to Western ears, and even here in Israel, we have a large Russian population. If I would have to advise Mr. Putin, I would advise him to use a different sentence to justify his war.
Now, can I broaden this out towards the issue of Nazism? Because I think it rests on two pillars. One is this idea of exceptional or sacred nature of any given ethnos, and the second, I think, is this issue of the end of history, that history has some predetermined moral end, and as we know, Hitler was trying to bring that about. Is that a concept that is seeing revival, not only, let's say, in Ukraine, but also more broadly?
Listen, we the Jews consider ourselves the chosen people. So, nobody, thinks that this is any part of Nazism.
But you are not.
Many nationalities think they are special, and so this is part of nationalism. Again, I think that this choice of words was not the best one.
But you mentioned that the Jews consider themselves the chosen people, but you are not trying to impose your way of life. In fact, you are quite restrictive about who can join your peoples. You have rules for that. But when we look, let's say, at the American Constitution, they not only define themselves as exceptional, but also see themselves as a city on the hill, and the only city on the hill, the ultimate judge, almost the replacement of God. I wonder if this Russian-American rivalry over the years is partially spiritually based, over whether one country can be the ultimate judge of what is good and what is evil in international affairs?
As you know, I refrain from making normative judgments. But it's, you know, every church believes it's the true church. And it has a direct line to God. And in that respect, probably, you know, the Christian ethos of America, which is actually becoming less and less so, is not that different from the revival of, what I understand, I'm not a specialist on the Orthodox Church in Russia, but I believe there is a revival in the, you know, it's Rome and Byzantium, you know, it's coming back. You know?
Absolutely, but I think any self-conscious nation wants to build its own, you know, heavenly Jerusalem, that's for sure. But I think very few nations, in fact, only one nation claims that, you know, this is one and only heavenly Jerusalem. You know, the Russian Orthodoxy allows for the multiplicity of gardens. The question is whether the Americans are ready to leave, even after this Ukrainian crisis, whether they are ready to accept that there could be multiplicity of developmental paths in the world and that not everything and not everybody will play to their tune.
Well, I would agree that there is a missionary strain in American foreign policy. And this is why we have those campaigns for democracy and campaigns for human rights, which actually blur the real national interest of the United States. And this is part of America. And there are some positive things about it. There are some negative things about it. But this is true that there is a missionary zeal sometimes in American foreign policy, which is not pragmatic when it displays too much of this type of desire to be moral and impose its morality on the whole world.
Now, in one of your articles, you pointed out that Ukrainian experience, being left one-on-one, as you put it, ruthless Russian neighbor, will reinforce Israel's belief in its self-protection doctrine that in the times of crisis, you can only rely on yourself, even if you nominally have very, very strong allies. Do you think Israel will be the only country to draw such lesson? Or do you think there will be more countries that will stop relying fully on the power of American deterrence?
I think we see in the Middle East a clear development in that direction, because Americans are signaling already three administrations, Obama, Trump, and the Biden administration, that they don't want to be in the Middle East. They want to retreat to focus on the Chinese challenge. And as a result of that, there are growing fears, particularly among those Arab oil-producing countries, that they will remain without a shield against Iran or other adversaries. And as a result of that, of course, we see realignment with Israel. But Israel definitely has a self-reliance doctrine from the very beginning. This is also our Jewish experience. And this reinforces, you know, there are no international guarantees are not worth much. I think the Ukrainians made a mistake, hoping that the West will intervene on their behalf. And despite all the help that the West is providing to Ukraine, but no single American soldier crosses the Ukraine border.
Can I also ask you about Europe? Because Europe, after a very long pacifist spell, now seems to be more willing to invest into its own defense, perhaps even offense. And that is very visible in Germany. Germany very dramatically rose its defensive expenditures. Is that something natural to be expected, or is it something to be, well, worried about in historical hindsight?
I think the Europeans made a mistake after the end of the Cold War, believing that they are going into a paradise. and all their national security problems will be solved after the defeat of the Soviet Union. So, of course they are wrong. And this is an awakening for Europe. I'm not sure for how long it will last. Maybe they will prefer, you know, there is this dilemma between butter and guns. They, after a while, may prefer to be buttered rather than use their money for guns. But this remains to be seen. But clearly, there is a change of attitude in Europe, in many European countries, on the issue of national defense.
Now, and I guess it's my final question. You mentioned this choice between butter and guns, and clearly there is also an economic damage that's coming to all sides from very harsh sanctions introduced by Europe and the United States. You mentioned before that your ultimate test of foreign policy is how well it serves national interests. Based on that, do you think the policy of sanctions is good enough for the Europeans, because it seems to be hurting not only the Russians, not only the Europeans, but also much of the world that has absolutely nothing to do with this, you know, age-old arguments between Russia and the West?
No, sanctions economic sanctions were rarely successful. You know, America tried sanctions against Iraq, against Cuba for many years, and it didn't change behavior of the regime. Countries are ready to suffer and to pay a heavy price for continuing with their policies. I doubt very much if the sanctions will change you know, the calculus of the Russian leadership. And of course, it remains to be seen. We shouldn't forget that the sanctions hurt also the West. But Europe in particular is dependent upon Russian energy, Russian wheat. So it is, you know, in every war, we have two equations, one who can cause more damage, but also another equation, who is the countries that can take more suffering. You know, from looking at history, I think Russia has displayed the willingness to pay a cost for what it believes it's important to.
Well, Professor Ingvar, I agree with you, but I also think that Russia definitely has showcased a capability to suffer a lot, but it also has demonstrated a willingness to reach some sort of a compromise, be it with Israel, Turkey, or many other contentious neighbors and partners. I hope the West can also learn from that.
Listen, probably the only possible, you know, positive outcome will be Finlandization of Ukraine. Actually, the Ukraine leader has already announced that he's not going to join NATO. I think the Russia miscalculated its the competence of its military forces, and will settle for you know, a small part of Ukraine, as Biden once said. You know, one piece, a small piece, it's okay. So. Maybe this will be the outcome, and maybe we'll see a more pragmatic, you know, Washington.
Well, time will tell, but for the time being, we have to leave it here. Thank you very much for your insights.
You are welcome.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart.